Well, welcome everybody to the Freedom Hour of Freedom Law School on this January 3rd, 2019. This is Payman Motaheda, the founder and president of Freedom Law School at livefreenow.org. And folks, this is our premier Freedom Hour of Freedom Law School. We used to have conference calls for many, many years. Now we are changing to the Freedom Hour. And next week, folks, hopefully, we will have the Freedom Hour on video. So you will get to see me and the things that I'll be showing you on internet, on my screen, to educate you about freedom, law, your rights, and how to live free of oppressive taxation control. Folks, every Thursday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live. We'll be live on YouTube, folks, and other places perhaps. My tech guy is working on this process right now. So tonight, folks, we have a great show. We're going to be honoring a great freedom patriot called Rhett Beckman, who passed away on December 30th, 2018, okay, at the age of 90, I'm told. I met Rhett Beckman, folks, many years ago, many times. But, folks, tonight, I'm going to, of course, as always, at the end of the Freedom Hour, which lasts longer than Freedom Hour, 1 hour usually, up to 2 hours or more sometimes, we're going to cover the educational program that we have for you every week about freedom issues, especially IRS, the monetary system, the crooked government, deep state officials, helping you live free of, you know, oppressive taxation and control. But once in a while, folks, I have a guest on these programs. I have one of my favorite guests that's the premier freedom, constitutional, money banking lawyer expert, Larry Becraft of Huntsville, Alabama, who I've known, folks, for almost 25 years, and also has known Mr. Rhett Beckman for a long time, even longer than me, folks. So, Larry, welcome to the Freedom Hour, my friend.
Well, it's great to be here, Payman. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you and all of our listeners, folks. We're going to talk about Rhett Beckman. I'm going to have asked a lot more from my guest, Larry Becraft, because, again, I'm 56, folks, and Larry's 67. I started when I was 29 years old in the movement. But Larry, you know, his background was, his father was a John Birch Society member. He went to law school. So he got started at a pretty young age also into all this kind of stuff. So he's been around longer than me and can tell you a lot more about Rhett Beckman. Larry, tell our listeners a little bit about this great man that, you know, he worked a lot tirelessly over many, many decades, educating and waking up the American people. Tell me, as far as you know, what is the background of this Rhett Beckman? Where did he come from?
Rhett Beckman, Martin J. Beckman, and his wife, Earlene, lived in Montana. I think he was living in Missoula when he died. But back in the 70s and 80s, you know, that was in the prime of Red's life, and he was very active in the freedom movement. You know, he was battling the IRS, he was battling state government, you know, he was engaged in a lot of the typical things that, you know, I wish more Americans were actively involved with. You know, Red was a leader of the freedom movement back in those days, and he was also writing a number of books. Now, Red's books were kind of written at a kind of a basic level. If you want to get on the internet and find out some of the books that Red has written, you know, I'm sure you can just do an internet search for Rhett Beckman books, and you can come up with quite a number of them. But what the reason I ended up meeting Rhett Beckman, I knew about him in the early 80s, but it was the research on the 16th Amendment issue that brought me into contact with Rhett Beckman. In early 1984, I heard about a project being sponsored by Rhett Beckman and Bill Benson to check out the ratification of the 16th Amendment. Here's how it got started. Just somebody from Montana in the early 80s had just simply engaged in a letter-writing campaign and had written to various state archivists and asked for information, any information, that related to the ratification of the 16th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Now, let me kind of summarize the amendment process. You know, there's several ways that an amendment can be proposed and made a part of the United States Constitution. It can either originate with the states, you know, like states can get together with a convention and propose an amendment to the United States Constitution, or an amendment can be proposed by Congress. Well, when the amendment is proposed by Congress, both houses of Congress will get together and pass a law saying, hey, we want to amend the Constitution in this specific fashion, and they'll propose an amendment. And then the states have to ratify the amendment that the Congress proposes. Now, in reference to the 16th Amendment, the reason why there was an amendment thought to be needed is in 1894, the United States Supreme Court had considered the constitutionality of the 1894 Income Tax Act, which was being challenged in a case called Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that that act was a direct tax. And since all direct taxes are required to be apportioned and that 1894 income tax was not apportioned, the Supreme Court found it to be unconstitutional. Well, the solution to this problem over the next 20 years ultimately became proposing an amendment to the United States Constitution. So in 1909, Congress comes along and proposes the 16th Amendment. Congress will have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. That's the wording of the 16th Amendment. Now, Red Beckman's friends back in the early 80s had sent off requests to get information about the ratification of the 16th Amendment, and they had gotten back a small package of information. You know, I don't know how many states were responding to this, but let's say that, you know, at least 10 states kind of responded to these requests for information. They sent the information to Red Beckman's friends, and from that they got this tentative idea, hey, maybe the 16th Amendment wasn't ratified. So in early, I'd say it's around about 1993, Bill Benson and Red Beckman got together, and they persuaded a man from Hartford, Connecticut, or Bristol, Connecticut, by the name of George Sitka, to come up with the money to send Bill around to all of the states to check out the ratification of the 16th Amendment. That required,
so 83 or 93, Larry, by the way? Was that 83 amendment?
That was in 83. 93. That was in 1983.
83, okay.
Because
okay,
Bill finished his mm-hmm. project in December, you know, after Christmas, December of 1984. But in 1983 mm-hmm. is when they were talking about, we need to send somebody around to do this project. And Bill was available to, you know, do the traveling. Bill was a good researcher. So finally they came up with the money to send Bill around to each state capital. Now, all of this whole story about the ratification of the 16th Amendment, you can read about it in Bill Benson's book, The Law That Never Was. There's a volume 1 of The Law That Never Was, and there's a volume 2 of The Law That Never Was. But in early 1984, once they got the funding for this project, Bill started periodically going to each of the state capitals to check out the ratification of the 16th Amendment. Now, by the summer of 1984, Bill had seen that, you know, here he has all this information. Let's say he's going to Atlanta, Georgia, to check out how Georgia ratified the 16th Amendment. He's walking into archives, and he's seeing that, you know, gee, the archives for that state has information, you know, documents coming from Washington, D.C., and then there's letters going back and forth between the Secretary of State of the state of Georgia and the Secretary of State up there in Washington, D.C., and, you know, they've got these Senate and House journals regarding how a proposal to ratify the amendment was appearing in the official documents and records of the particular state. So Bill began to see that, you know, gee, there's a lot of information going back and forth between Washington, D.C. and these state capitals. So he reached the conclusion that, gee, there must be some types of documentation up in Washington, D.C. And so in about August of 1984, Bill actually went to Washington, D.C. You know, he'd probably done maybe 25 or 30 states at that time, and he knew that there had to be some information in Washington, D.C. about the ratification of the 16th Amendment. So he went up to the archives in Washington, D.C. About August of 1984, and there he did indeed find a book in archives. You know, what they had, and I've held this book in my hand too. You know, it's a big old thick book. You know, imagine a heavy book that you're going to keep important historical information in. You know, it's like a three-ring spiral-bound notebook, except it's very large, probably about 3 feet by 3 feet. And inside that book, you know, you would have these documents, you know, placed into on pages, stapled or, you know, appended to pages, so that all of the federal documents that were related to the ratification of the 16th Amendment was in this one book. And Bill requested the archives send it to him, and they brought it to him, and he looked at it and said, boom, this is real important. So he got a certified copy of all that. In fact, wherever Bill went in reference to the ratification of the 16th Amendment, he got all of the documents that he got from all the states. They were all certified. So once Bill got this information from Washington, D.C., that was real important. It showed what Secretary of State Philander Knox was doing in reference to the ratification of the 16th Amendment back in about 1910, 1911, 1912, 1913, you know, which included, you know, in February of 1913, Philander Knox was sitting down and having to make a decision. Gee, this amendment's been acted upon by a number of states. Has it been ratified? And he wrote an official document, you know, outlining the defects in the ratification of the 16th Amendment and coming up with a conclusion. Gee, we're going to go ahead and propose this amendment. We're going to claim that it's been ratified and thus is a part of the United States Constitution. Even including things like in Kentucky, you know, when the Kentucky legislature was voting on the 16th Amendment, you know, the Senate actually voted against it. But the reason why the 16th Amendment was reported as ratified by Kentucky is because, you know, after the Kentucky Senate voted against it, I think in 1910, the following year, somebody, Crook, and the government in Kentucky sent documents to Washington, D.C., saying that Kentucky had ratified the 16th Amendment, even though, you know, you can, you know, I've got in my records here in my office, I've got certified copies of the legislative records of Kentucky showing that Kentucky never voted in favor of the 16th Amendment. But those are the things that happened. Now, by December of 1984, Bill Benson had completed his project. And right after that, we started. I was the first lawyer to raise the issue of the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment. I was representing J.D. Ferguson in a case up in Indianapolis, Indiana. She had been indicted for tax crimes up there, and we were set for trial in January of 1985. And so I can remember on New Year's Day of 1985, I'm in my office drafting the motion to have the indictment against Janie Ferguson dismissed because the tax laws that she was charged with having violated were based upon and dependent upon the 16th Amendment, and the 16th Amendment was not legally ratified. Now, I bring all this stuff up about the 16th Amendment because, you know, those are the circumstances in which Bill Benson and Red Beckman got together. And Bill and Red were both working on the 16th Amendment project, and that's where Bill Benson and Red Beckman got their greatest notoriety, is because they were involved in this particular project. Now, to make a long story short, you know, for years we battled the issue over the ratification of the 16th Amendment, and the courts ultimately determined that, gee, the question of the ratification of an amendment to the United States Constitution is not a judicial question. It is a political question. The political branch of the federal government, Congress, will tell the courts whether or not an amendment to the United States Constitution has been ratified, and that decision is therefore, quote, binding on the courts. And that's their rationale for avoiding the issue of the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment or the defects in the ratification of the 16th Amendment. So, while we can take a pause here for a moment, Payman, before we go on to a little bit more about Red Beckman, if you want to ask some questions about this argument about the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment. Do you have a question?
Well, Philander Knox was the Secretary of United States government, the officer that's in charge of overseeing the process of the ratification of the constitutional amendment. We refer to Knox, correct?
Right, right.
Okay.
He was
Secretary of State.
And when Congress proposed an amendment to the United States Constitution, the states will send information about whether or not they ratified amendment back to the Secretary of State. And once the Secretary of State receives enough ratifications or actions by the states, he'll sit down and, you know, make a determination as to whether or not the states ratified a constitutional amendment. And that's what Philander Knox did. And Philander Knox even made a detailed study of the defects regarding the 16th Amendment. You know, there were states that changed the wording of the 16th Amendment. You know, Oklahoma, you know, the 16th Amendment arguably is designed to eliminate the requirement of apportioning one type of direct tax, known as the income tax, from the requirement of apportionment. However, Oklahoma changed the 16th Amendment so that income taxes could be imposed only still with the requirement of apportionment. And that's the type of defects and flaws that you find when you sit down and take a look at, you know, the ratification process of the 16th Amendment. You know, the 14th Amendment was the same way. You know, the 17th Amendment got substantial defects. While Bill was doing the 16th Amendment research, he was also at the same time doing the 17th Amendment. But what was most interesting to most people was the research regarding the 16th Amendment, because it showed that, you know, the constitutional threshold for the required number of states to ratify the 16th Amendment hadn't been reached. You know, we had 48 states in the Union back then, and it took 36 states to ratify the 16th Amendment. And when you take, you know, Philander Knox came along and said, I think my memory is that he declared that 38 or 39 states ratified the 16th Amendment. So all we had to do is come up with, you know, three or four states to show that there were substantial defects, and therefore the state can't be considered to have legally ratified the amendment. And we think we did that, you know. And Bill said in his book, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1, he takes the documentation for each state and tells you what the flaws are. And he does that in his first book, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1. So, do you have any other questions?
On thelawthatneverwas.com, by the way, for everybody, folks. If you go to thelawthatneverwas.com, is Bill Benson's website, which talks about this process of the so-called ratification of the 16th Amendment. It talks about that. And Rhett Beckman's website is rhettbeckman.com, BECKMAN.com. Go ahead and continue, please, Larry.
Well, you know, there's not a whole lot more I want to say about the 16th Amendment, and my contact with Red was primarily through our work on the ratification of the 16th Amendment. You know, after this issue was kicked off at big time in 1985, and especially after Bill's book came out, you know, Bill and Red and I and a few others, we'd get out on the speaker circuit. We went around the country telling people about this. And back in the late 80s, you know, this was a very hot issue. But we raised it in a large number of cases. You know, I remember one time when we raised it out in Los Angeles, and it was in this. There was this leader of a tax group out there in Los Angeles, who had been indicted, and we filed the same motion to attack his indictment, moving to have it dismissed because of the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment. You know, if the 16th Amendment doesn't exist, gee, how in the world can you have a constitutional income tax laws? And that's the argument. You know, in this one case where we were having arguments in Los Angeles, you know, I was going there to, argue the motion. And, you know, when I got there, you know, there was a line of people going outside the courthouse. And I said, wow, that's a big line. What are these people there for? And when I went upstairs to the courtroom, you know, that line went all the way into the courtroom. And then when I went into the courtroom, you know, the courtroom was completely packed. And so, you know, the same thing happened out in the Ninth Circuit. We had arguments on the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment in an appeal in that same guy's case. The Ninth Circuit had it, had the arguments in the appeal up in Seattle, and you know, the Seattle courtroom for the appeal was packed too. You know, I even remember seeing, I saw George Washington and I saw Thomas Jefferson and a whole bunch of our founding fathers came to those oral arguments. You know, people dressed like them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were there.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Right.
Tom Jefferson, Ben Franklin. but, you know, Red's notoriety, you know, Red was a real dyed-in-the-wool, red-blooded American, you know, like his name said, Red Beckman. Red, Martin J. Beckman is his name. Red is his nickname because of his red hair. And he was just a, you know, good, honest, decent American that was concerned about the course and direction of this country. And he saw the problems that we see today. And he was very active in, you know, trying to write these great social injustices. And he and Bill Benson teamed up together to, you know, Red didn't do the travel that Bill did to check out the ratification of the 16th Amendment. You know, Red didn't contribute a lot to the writing of the books, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1 and 2. But you know, Red did promote the issue and did his he had a substantial impact on you know, spreading the word about the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment and educating people about that. You know, after the 16th Amendment issue kind of died down, you know, by say like 91 and 92, there wasn't a whole lot more to do regarding the 16th Amendment. Bill Benson had been indicted, you know, back in 1987. You know, hey, if you do something like this, you know, do the research on the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment, you know, the government's going to come along, and, you know, if you're involved in that, you're going to get indicted. And that's what happened to Bill Benson. And, you know, Bill Benson got indicted. He got convicted the first time around, got a reversal on appeal, then he got retried. And, you know, Bill went through the ringer over all of this. Red didn't, but Red was suffering from, you know, the IRS had filed a lien against him. And in the late 90s, you know, they foreclosed on his farm up in Montana. But, you know, Red was, you know, I would say probably in the early 2000s, he fell into real poor health. He didn't travel all that much. He didn't do much. But, you know, he would do radio shows, and I'm sure he did some videotapes and did some limited appearances. He spoke mainly around, you know, after he quit traveling around with us on the tour, so to speak, teaching people about the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment, you know, Red kind of would do his own thing, sell his books, write his books, you know, appear on for some videos and be a guest on some radio shows. But Red was a great, in my opinion, a great American. And we have suffered a loss with his death here in the last couple of days.
And, you know, if people go to his website at redbeckman.com and tab up there, you click on the books link. So you see the Red Beckman's books, The Law That Never Was, Born Again Republic, Why the Militia, Walls in Our Minds, one of my favorites, Walls in Our Minds, The Church Deceived, very important book about how the churches have been deceived into, you know, not standing for freedom and allow the corruption to continue and grow in America. So these are, folks, you might think these are old books. They're written 20, 30 years ago, but they're just as applicable today to what's going on with our rights and our freedoms. You know, and folks, what Freedom Law School does with Larry Becraft, what we do, Joe Bannister, all of us folks in the movement nowadays, we really are continuing the great work that great people like Red Beckman, like Urban Schiff, like John Cotmere, like Robert Clarkson, like Vivian Kellum, A.J. Porth, and others that have come before us in a decade since World War II, where the modern income tax got to be misapplied and misimposed on the American people. You know, they've laid the groundwork for what we're doing now to continue the battle. Our quest for freedom to expose the lies, the crookedness of the deep state, of the big banks, and the permanent bureaucracy, and the big corporations, all in collusion, folks, to turn this country in a crony capitalist communist state where we the people are a bunch of stupid, idiot, poor folks, you know, working slaves, while they, the elite, the banksters, and their politicians and their bureaucrats and their corporations rule over us.
Right.
And they keep us busy with a bunch of entertainment. Used to be the television, folks, was entertainment. Now, besides cable TV, now you got the smartphones. And everybody on this Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook and all these other applications, you know, on your apps, on your phone, and video games on your phones. I don't call them phones. I call them entertainment devices. To keep people fooled and busy and brainwashed with entertainment, and while we are being robbed and controlled like a bunch of dumb sheeple slave chattel. And Rhett, like I said, I met him you know, many times, and one of the interesting things he told me about, that Bible lady Rhett, told me that in the early 2000 years, is that when Bill Benson came out with the book The Law Never Was, even though Bill is the one that traveled with a private airplane paid by Sitka to travel to the state archives and get the documentation about the non-ratification of the 16th and 17th Amendments. But because Bill Benson was not very well known at that time, Red Beckman was well known in the Freedom Patriot Movement. Red put his name on the book, he told me, to give credibility to the important research and work that Bill Benson had done.
Right.
And that's how come Red's name got to be on there, even though Red didn't actually do the work. And so this way, a lot more people heard about the important research about the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment, which, by the way, folks, this is an issue that at Freedom Law School's website, folks, by the 16th Amendment, we, you know, it's talked about, folks. Okay? If you go to Freedom Law School's website, okay, under Educational Material tab, okay, you'll see, you go down there on the tab called Uncertainties of the Income Tax. Larry Beecraft has an article which talks about the Supreme Court cases, about 16th Amendment, about how some courts have said that 16th Amendment did change the Constitution. Some say it didn't. You know, some says the direct, some says the income tax is an indirect tax. The whole confusion with a crooked court system, but the one thing that all the crooked courts agree, even though they don't know if an income tax is a direct or indirect tax, some say it's both, which is like being a dog and a cat at the same time, being a fish and a bird at the same time. It cannot be. But the one thing all this government paid bias, crooked deep state courts agree is with the Department of Injustice is that we all got to pay it. That's it. Just shut up and pay. You all got to pay your fair share of slavery. And they're treating us like a bunch of stupid crabs you put in a pot. As soon as the crab wants to get out of the pot, the other crabs drag him back. Because if you don't pay, if you are free from the slavery, then the rest of us have to pay more. That's how they get our fellow Americans riled up against us, that you are not a patriot. You're not trying to expose the income tax fraud. You're trying not to pay your fair share. So the rest of us have to hold harder. I heard that from a U.S. tax court judge in a court case. Oh, yes, the rest of us have to hold or, you know, harder. That's the mindset of these guys. So, all right, Larry. Well, how about if you take some callers with questions, folks?
Yeah, I'm going to leave here in about 5 minutes. I can take a couple calls.
Yeah. So let's take the calls about this issue of Red Beckman and the 16th Amendment issue, related issues, folks, from Larry. Because after Larry's gone, I'll be happy to help you with your other individual personal questions you guys may have about your personal freedom issues, questions you have. You know, I do it on every one of these Freedom Hour shows that we have. So let's go to the call from area code 214 area code, my friend. Give me your first name. Tell me if you have Freedom Oscar's Freedom Education Package at livefreenow.org, our website, and then ask your question of Larry B. Craft or myself. What's your first name, sir? Hello, call from Erica 214. You are live with on the show. Call
Hello?
From Erica 214. Are you there? Yes. What's your first name?
Hello?
Yes.
Are you talking to me?
Yes,
oh,
sir.
My name's Ray.
You have a question?
I just was listening. I don't have a question.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, if you folks, if you push 1 on your telephone keypad, which apparently they call from Erica 214 area code accidentally by mistake did, that will let me know that you have a question, and I will get to your question in turn. So, again, if anybody on the call tonight has a question from me or Larry B. Craft on Red Beckman, on the Sixth Amendment, on any of these related issues, go ahead and push 1 on your telephone keypad. That will let me know you have a question, and I will get to each one of you one person at a time. Let's go to the caller we have right now from area code 213 and downtown Los Angeles area. What is your first name, my friend?
My name is Gary. Hi, Payman. And how you doing, Larry?
Hey, Gary, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I have a copy of the book, The Law That Never Was. I wanted to ask you a question that it talks about here on page 24. This is what he wrote. He said, a resolution to amend the Constitution must already have received a two-thirds vote of each branch of the legislature. Such a resolution is therefore beyond the reach of the veto and consequently beyond the necessity for a presidential approval. So I think by making that statement, wasn't he showing that this this idea of adding to the Constitution, the amendment, it, just in the very process of itself, it never went through, right?
Well, I don't think that the purpose of the 16th Amendment research was to do exactly that. Bill's purpose was to first acquire. They had enough information from what Red Beckman's friend had done to see that, you know, it certainly was worthwhile to check out the ratification of the 16th Amendment. Once Bill started going to the state capitals and getting the documents, that's when it became clear that there was a problem. Like, for example, in Oklahoma, like, for example, in Kentucky, you know, Oklahoma ratified something different from the 16th Amendment. You know, the Kentucky legislature or the Senate voted against the 16th Amendment. Now, here's the problem, and I have, if you go over to my website, I have a lot of legal material on a particular website. It's not my LarryBCraft.org website, which is just simply for my office, but I have a Dixieland Law Journal that is posted on my Internet service provider, so it has a very odd URL. So if you want to get to this particular website of mine that has legal material on it, simply type in Beecraft Briefs or Dixieland Law Journal, and that will carry you over to the Dixieland Law Journal. Now, the front page of my website, this Dixieland Law Journal, is kind of simplistic. You go down, you know, there's not but about 7 or 8 links from the first page. You know, the links from the first page, the front page, will carry you over to other pages. You know, I discussed the money issue and the tax issue and stuff like that. Click on the tax page, and that'll carry you over to a page that deals with the issue regarding the 16th Amendment. Now, if you know, there's a lot of other information on the taxation page, but you can find the material regarding the 16th Amendment over on my website, which, you know, I've got a brief, that kind of goes through the legal arguments that are put up that we were making regarding the 16th Amendment. You know, you'll find that there are cases that deal with this issue. The issue is that legislative bodies have to agree upon the same, you know, legislative act. When it comes to, you know, there's an enroll bill rule and there's a journal entry rule. in these states. Some states will allow you to attack a law, and other states say that, no, you can't do it. But in the states that say you can do it, you know, the typical way to do it is to look for what one body of a legislative body enacted, and then you compare it with the, you know, what was ratified or adopted by the other body. And if there are differences in, you know, the two legislative acts, you know, a Senate and a House, they have to agree upon the same precise law. And if they do not do that, if they adopt, you know, different laws, then the legislature hadn't assented to the same law, and therefore it isn't a law. And if you go over to my taxation page on my website and go down and look through the, you know, for the other file that deals with ratification of amendments, you will find a wealth of cases that deal with this precise point. You know, there's been a lot of litigation over the, you know, since the founding of this country, where people have gone to court and said, hey, you know, in some kind of silly laws or some really important laws. You know, there's a lot of things that kind of squeak through. It's happened at the state level. It's happened at the federal level. You know, at the federal level, you know, they follow the enroll bill rule, and whatever the Secretary of State says is was sent to him by, you know, by Congress. You know, that's the law, and you can't sit there and attack. You know, sit there and say, hey, there's minor differences or major differences between what was enacted by both houses of Congress. But there is a substantial body of law outlined in this brief I've got posted on my website, you know, that shows that there's a lot of cases, and this includes, you know, amendments. You know, people have come along and attacked state constitutional amendments by showing that there was a defect in the, you know, ratification process. So there's a lot of authority that deals with this issue of, you know, is there case law that says that differences between legislative bodies that have to assent to the same, you know, law, you know, whether it's a regular old law or whether it's a constitutional amendment or a constitution, that's still a law. You know, if you've got a legislative body or two houses of a legislative body that have to both approve the same law, if you can show differences in the laws that each house approved, then there is no law. And a substantial number of cases on that point are in this brief that I've got posted over on my website. Now, that's what I think is the way I answer your question, Gary. Did it do that? Did I answer your question?
Oh, yeah, sure. I can see that even by reading the book here, that what he shows is there's no consistency between the Senate and the House in each one of the individual states. And one in particular, which I'm reading, is in South Carolina. He shows that there's been a ton of changes, and it's like it doesn't fit in, or it doesn't make it's completely different than what was submitted originally. It seems
that's true. And you got to remember, you know, this is back when, you know, having cars, you know, the nation, this country was still, the major transportation was trains and horses and buggies. You know, cars were, you know, we certainly didn't have airplanes, and we certainly didn't have most of the population didn't have cars. And, you know, traveling across the country was real difficult. So back in those days, you know, they had, you know, substantial problems in the ratification of this constitutional amendment. The 14th Amendment had the same problem. The 17th Amendment had the same problem. And yet, you know, here we can find out, and today, you know, we can go into these archives and dig out all this material, and, you know, but the courts come along and say, you know, well, gee, you know, it's been here for a long time. You know, we're not going to disturb, you know, the executive branch of the government, Philander Knox or a Secretary of State coming along and saying that an amendment has been ratified, that's good enough for us. That's the position of the federal courts.
Right. Well, you know, when it talks about in South Carolina, he points out several things. Like, if, for instance, they changed words. It says the word lay that was in about laying taxes was changed to levy.
Yeah.
And then he
yeah.
talks about period was changed to a comma. So they just changed everything. Everything seemed to be changed just to fit the circumstance, whatever they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the 16th Amendment ratification process. That's also the 17th Amendment ratification process. You know, when you sit down and you actually take a look at the documents, you compare Senate Joint Resolution 39 that came out of Washington, D.C., and you compare that with, you know, what was sent to Washington, D.C. by the states, you know, there's big differences. And Flander Knox noted that. He came out with a report in February of 1913 that outlined a lot of the flaws that you can see regarding this, but he still nonetheless said, hey, you know, the states want the amendment. I'm going to proclaim it as ratified. And that's what happened.
So simply by his proclamation, that still doesn't make it ratified, does it?
Well, you know, years ago, you know, decades ago, more than 100 years ago, Congress came along and in reference to constitutional amendments, you know, before when, you know, like for the first 10 amendments, you know, that happened in the 1790s. You know, they didn't have a, you know, other than what the Constitution says about amending the United States Constitution, there wasn't anything, any, quote, legislative acts that applied to the amendment process. And that was still the same condition back at the time of the Civil War when we had the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But, you know, Congress eventually came along and said, well, you know, we're having all of these the acts of ratification or rejection by the various states. They're going to the Secretary of State. So they passed a law, you know, saying that, you know, when sufficient material from the states comes in to the Secretary of State's office, you know, the Secretary of State will sit down and examine that and then make a proclamation as to whether or not the amendment's been ratified. That's the way it's been for 150 years and more. And that's the way it is today. Revised Statute Section 205, and it's in Title I today. You know, that law that authorizes the Secretary of State to proclaim ratification of an amendment. So that's the way that Congress has come along and addressed, you know, has enacted some statutes that deal with this process of ratifying amendments to the United States Constitution. And so rather than doing something like they did with the, you know, I think it's with the 14th Amendment, you know, they just, you know, they had a debate as to whether or not the 14th Amendment had been ratified. And, you know, I think that the Secretary of State at that time regarding the 14th Amendment, you know, made a report to Congress, and then Congress just sat there and, you know, said, well, gee, you know, the Congress itself examined the ratification of the 14th Amendment, and it came out with a proclamation saying, oh, well, it's been ratified. Well, then they simply passed this law to, rather than having Congress do that, you know, they said, hey, we're going to have a public official, you know, check out the ratification. And his proclamation will mean that an amendment has been passed, will make that amendment a part of the Constitution. So, you know, that's the way it is. It's been for that for more than 150 years. You know, I've come along, and in these cases dealing with the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment, you know, I've made arguments about the unconstitutionality of that statute. You know, how in the world, you know, can you bring in an executive officer and make him part of the amendment of the lawmaking process? An amendment to the United States, amendment to the United States Constitution, that's clearly lawmaking. That's a legislative function. But this legislative function has been delegated to somebody in the executive branch. I've made those arguments in these appeals dealing with the 16th Amendment, but, you know, the courts didn't buy the arguments. So
yeah.
It's been, you know, the Bill's work regarding the ratification of the 16th Amendment was very thorough. He got everything that you could possibly get. He got it all certified. And, you know, we've been to court with the best arguments you could possibly make. And, you know, I'm just giving you the report about what happened. You know, we were not successful in persuading the federal courts. And we even did it in one state. You know, we even We even brought a lawsuit and to challenge the ratification in Oklahoma. But, you know, the courts don't want to get rid of the 16th Amendment.
I was reading this in Maine when they went before the House and they were talking there. It says, it says we must remember this, that there is not a laboring man today who does not, through that method, pay 5 to 10 or even, yes, up to 15% at least of all the money that he earns for the support of the federal government. And the man of large accumulations, if you cannot get at him through the agency of the income tax, there is absolutely no way to reach him. So then they say, and this is in bold print, and that is the purpose for which the Congress of the United States has submitted to the various legislatures a resolution asking for its adoption in each state, that it may have the power to lay a tax on incomes, because the poor laborer contributes more to the cost of government than does the richest woman in the United States.
Yeah.
It's insanity.
Yeah. Hey, Gary, let me tell you, Phil Hart wrote a book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? And if you haven't read that, the book's still available. You know, Phil lives up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Phil is a former Idaho state legislator. You know, he got into that very issue right there, you know, telling what is the real purpose of reach and scope of the 16th Amendment. And what you have just stated is the gist of Phil's conclusion that he reaches in his book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? So if you haven't read it, you ought to get it.
Okay, will do. That sounds good. Add it to my library.
Yeah. Okay. Glad you called in tonight.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate your time and appreciate you being on the show with payment. You have a lot to offer.
We need more people listening
in.
You know, one of the things is I've noticed over the years, you know, if you go back 10, 15, and 20 years, you know, our means of communication were not like what they are today. We didn't have the internet. You know, we didn't have long distance calling that doesn't cost anything anymore. You know, our means of communication are so much better today. They're so much better than what we had 50, 60, and 100 years ago. But yet, even though we've got better communication capabilities today, I've got this simple question. Why was the movement a lot more active in the past than it is today? Real problem we have.
Well, Larry, I think what the difference is now versus the old days in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and even early 2000 years, was that you got to see in person, face to face, the leaders of the movement as well as the activists in meeting rooms and hotel rooms and meeting halls. Nowadays, we have all these callers right now, Larry, listening to us on this call, and they're all across America by telephone and through their smartphone or computers are hooking up. That's the main difference. We've got to come that way. But I think bottom line is it's a spirit, folks. This is a spiritual fight for freedom, for truth, and if we're getting it out there, and there's those of us who care about the truth, who care about freedom, okay, who care about justice, and peace, and those that don't care, they just, as long as they got beer, barbecue on their smartphone or entertainment, you know, rent and mortgage covered, they got gas in the car, they're happy as a lark because they don't even think about anything. So that's what seems to be going on, Larry.
Well, hey, Payman, I'm going to have to run. My wife is expecting me to get dinner, and she's told me to to call
her
20
Larry.
Minutes ago.
Go
okay, I've enjoyed it,
your wife, my
good
friend.
Show.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, Larry. Thank you. Okay, folks, so the Freedom Hour, although it's called the Freedom Hour, doesn't necessarily last an hour. It lasts sometimes longer. So what I will be doing next, if those of you have questions about this topic or other freedom topics, I'm happy to answer them for you, provided you push 1 on your telephone keypad and let me know that you do have a question. I know we do have a caller from area code 215, area code, who in the past tried to call us, Tim, and had trouble getting the call, folks. By the way, if those of you, and once in a while you cannot get on the call, that one telephone keypad doesn't work, and we had that heard from Tim and others, You can go to our website at livefreenow.org, livefreenow.org. At the very bottom of the page, it says contact us. Click on that link that says contact us, and then you see an email. You can email us and say, hey, here, I'm trying to get on a call or ask a question. I'm having trouble getting on the call, or I push one on my telephone keypad. It doesn't work. This is my phone number. Please ask me. Let me ask a question. Unmute me so I can ask a question. So put your name and telephone number on there, first name only and telephone number, and we'll get to you like we'll do right now with Tim. So, Tim, thank you for calling back again, my friend, not giving up on your questions. How can I help you today, my friend?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, Tim, go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, Tim, go ahead. I can hear you.
I have a question with when my situation is we have a lien on the property from the IRS, and we want to we're working on a reverse mortgage. So when you do that, I assume that we just pay off the IRS and they accept that. I had emailed you in our situation with the lien with the IRS, but I'm not sure that you had a chance to see that or not. So I'm just trying to find out, how do I deal with them? Do I deal with the mortgage first and then pay them, or do I notify them, or should I just let them ride until I figure it out?
Well, you have options, but it depends on your situation, okay? If you're in a hurry, you have less options. If you want to get a reverse mortgage now, you don't have much of an option because you're going to have to pay the IRS in the process of a reverse mortgage and then later on sue the IRS to get your money back. If you pay the tax in full, not the penalty and interest, but the tax itself part only, you can sue to get the money back, and you're going to get earned 4.5% interest on your money right now. Whatever rate the IRS charges people, they have to pay you. Okay? So that's your immediate option, looks like. Okay? Now, if you're not in a hurry, then we can go and challenge the tax. I have a process where I can challenge the tax to see if the IRS has followed the proper procedures or not. And if not, then we can have the tax declared to be illegal, the lien to be declared illegal, and have it removed if necessary. You know, we can get, you know, have a court order the IRS to remove the lien. But it depends on your situation again. How much is the amount of the tax? For what years did you file or not? How long the lien been on there for? These are all different questions I need to know. I need to look at your paperwork to be able to give you a better, more accurate answer. So it's kind of like calling the doctor. Hey, doctor, I know you've been doing for 25 years brain surgery, and I got this problem. But can you tell me what to do? Well, your problem is so detailed. Without the paperwork, I cannot give you a more specific answer, Tim. You know. Well, let me ask you, are you in a hurry, or can you wait?
Well, the situation is that the problem is not really with the IRS. He has a non-collections. It's in non-collections for 10 years, and it goes away or until he dies. It's my father. And so we need to get away from the bank because the bank is attempting to foreclose. So I need to get the reverse mortgage, and to get the reverse mortgage, I have to pay off the lien.
Well, now you just made this situation even more complicated. You're behind on your mortgage. And because you're behind on your mortgage, because I imagine you guys are short on funds, I suspect, you try to get another loan. But to get another loan on the house, you have to pay off the IRS first. So it's a chicken and egg
situation. Right, that's what I'm asking. Do I notify them first and pay them off and then pay the bank off?
How much is the IRS? How much the IRS owed?
Not that much, $15,000.
For what years?
Oh, way back. Let me see. It was 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Okay, 6, 8, 9, and 10. And was the tax 1040 income tax confession filed for those years or not?
No, the IRS provided an attorney for my dad, and they got him into what they called non-collections, and he did not have to pay it.
Okay.
They put a lien against the house.
Yeah, I think in this situation you have to pay the IRS off and then get the reverse mortgage.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Okay.
Yeah. You need to hear that. Otherwise, the bank will take the house altogether from you. You lose everything. You know? So you might as well pay that IRS off. And then we can do what we can do, my friend. We can get that $15,000 back. You know? By, you know, going after it with a refund claim against the IRS, and then, if necessary, a refund lawsuit against the IRS. And eventually, you can get the money back, all or part of it, with interest.
Okay, well, the equity would come from the reverse mortgage, so it's there to pay them, so might as well do it.
Right. Right, that's what I would
do. Pay them, then pay off the bank, and get free of everybody. And then file the reclaim.
And then you got money to also to pay someone like Freedom Law School to help you get the $15,000 that you paid the IRS back with interest, which is a 4.5% is a decent rate of return for a guaranteed interest rate. It's not like there's a risk of that in the stock market that you might make a lot of money on your stocks and dividends, or not very good. The stock market goes up and down. You have none of those risks. You're going to get, when you win, you will win, you're going to get paid 4.5% interest on your money as well.
Well, that's why I'm on the conference call, because it's not what you make, it's what you keep, right?
Right, or what you get back in your case.
Yeah, well, same difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, in other words, I'm getting the equity, let's get the equity, let's get them out of our hair, let's not wait for you to die or live like that. Go get this, let's knock them out of the picture. Let's get the bank out of our lives and get this axe from over our head.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is my
yes,
thinking.
That's what I would do.
And,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know,
yep.
of course, we're following up. That gives me the money to follow up with you, doesn't it?
Yes. And that gives the money to fight back the IRS also. It gives the money to pay off the bank. It gives the money to pay off the IRS. It gives the money to live. And it gives the money to fight back and get the $15,000 back, hopefully.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Okay.
But you don't always hear what
Very
you want to hear. You're not a kind of guy that placates people or tells them what they want to hear. That's why it's very important to run that past you and make sure that my strategy or my thinking was clear.
Well, I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. I'm going to tell you the truth. Hopefully what I tell you is the truth, my bet, is what you want to hear as well. You know, in your case, you know, it's kind of not exactly what you want to hear, but hopefully it was close.
Well, it's a path, which is what I have to have, you know, because now unless I do this, I don't have a path.
Right. At least you have an option right now. You have some plan of action to do something for it. Yes, sir, go do it. You know, your father's old. Let him enjoy the rest of his life. You know, there's no reason to let the IRS stop him from enjoying his life. You know, just go do what you got to do, my friend. And then, you know, and then, like you said, and then you can send me the paperwork that you got. We can do a private one-hour consultation. I get more details from you and give you a more specific path based upon your paperwork of what you got and exactly how we can execute this stuff.
Right. I'm meeting with my funder for the application tomorrow. So what I have to do is the house is in my name. The IRS attorney had me do that. So I have to get my dad's name back on the house to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Both of us. Mm-hmm. Both of us will be on it.
Right. Right.
That sound right?
That sounds good to me, Tim.
That's what I need to verify, you know. And coming from you, that's where I needed to come from.
You're good. You got a plan of action now.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to have to get back to you and get started in the first plan, even though right now I have to put the money into things. I'm fixing up the roof and all and everything because I got to get the equity up right away. You know, for the appraisal.
Right.
So I'm a little tied up with the money, or I'd be sending it to you right now, but I got to, you know, I'm fixing up things here so I can get that money out of the appraisal so it'll be there in the future
fix up the house,
to pay you down
the
road.
IRS, clear out, get some cash in your pocket. Now that frees you up. It frees up your options.
Okay. Just want to make sure I'm thinking clearly, and you've only given me good advice every time I talk to you.
All right. You're welcome, Tim. All right.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your question. You are welcome, Tim. Okay, folks, if you have a question, push 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, that will let me know you have a question. We have a caller right now from area code 419 area code. Remember, my friend, give me only your first name to protect your privacy. Tell me you have our free freedom education package, and then your question, please.
Hi, my name's Jim.
Hello,
and
Jim.
I was wondering, did Donald Trump, is he changing the tax laws? Is he getting rid of the Federal Reserve and IRS and stuff?
Not yet.
Unfortunately.
Donald Trump did not, unfortunately, I support him overall. But he has not been even had the guts to go against the deep state and force the U.S. Department of Justice to unclassify and declassify those documents that the U.S. Department of Justice withheld from Congress and congressional investigators. He could have done that. Should have done that. He didn't do that. You know, which is very disappointing to me. He also did not order the U.S. Department of Justice to set up grand juries to properly investigate the crimes of Hillary Rodham Clinton. You know, that murderous U.S. Department of Secretary of State.
Did he pardon her, or what's going on?
He
with her?
Practically
pardoned her,
but not ordering the U.S. Department of Justice to have a citizen grand jury set up to investigate and bring all the evidence before the grand jury. See, that's what all these guys do. They deliberately do not set up grand juries to investigate.
Yeah.
Because federal law says federal crimes, basically, they got to indict you. They got to take you before the grand jury, the alleged crimes before the grand jury. So they exonerated Hillary, but not taking the case before the grand jury. So she cannot be indicted. If the case does not go before the grand jury, there's nothing to indict. But if you're a political opponent of the deep state, of the communist deep state, like people close to Donald Trump, then they go after you, like his former campaign manager. They went after him. What's his name? The guy, they got him for tax stuff and all those things like that. You know, they got him. They set up a grand jury to go after him. So, no, I'm afraid that will not be happening. Any other questions, Jim?
Well, I was wondering, like, if I should just not file tax, but then, like, I get this thing in the mail that tells me that I got to file my city tax. Yeah,
where
and
do
I'm
you
like, well... In Findlay, Ohio.
Okay, Ohio is one of those states that has many counties and cities do have a city or county income tax. And those are different than the federal income tax. Under the state constitutions in many of those states, they do allow the counties and the cities to impose income tax, unfortunately. You know, there's lawful like the sales taxes. The only bad part is oftentimes they work with the federal government to work to go after you, but oftentimes they don't. So I cannot give you a yes-no answer, my friend. You got to educate yourself about these issues a little bit more. Because remember, I cannot be your mother or daddy because the crooked government, you know, wants to say I'm the conspirator to defraud the government, and I'm not. I'm trying to expose their crime and help you.
Last year I filed zero income, and
with
I
who?
Haven't heard
IRS
about
them. Or the city, with who?
With all of them.
Okay, and?
And I didn't hear nothing from anyone, but so like this year
okay.
I was gonna not file at all, but you say I think I should file zero again or just. I mean, like, there actually, I had a couple of jobs, and I got a job now, so I have a little bit of income that they already took taxes out of, you know. But
listen, I wish it was as simple as that, Jim, me telling you to file or downfile, pay and not pay. I wish it was that simple. And when I got involved at age 29 in 1992 in the movement, that's what I was hoping and looking, that we have an honest government and courts that would simply follow the law with simple things that it should be. That's how it should be, my friend. I understand that. But sadly, that is not our government. We have in America a communist government. We've been overtaken. The former communist Soviet Union is dead, is broken apart, but they're here now. We have a system of government-paid, government-biased, crooked, wimpy judges are protecting the deep state of robbing the American people. So it takes more study of the law to understand law and your rights and what to do. That is why I started Freedom Law School. So rather you depending on me to tell you what to do, like a mommy, daddy, or doctor, you know, is you understand the law and take responsibility for your actions. And I can support you to help you win. So at the very minimum, I would recommend you start with our first course, which is called A Practical Road to Freedom from Oppressive Taxation and Control Level 1. That is the most fundamental, basic course out there, foundation of everything that Freedom Law School teaches. You want to get that course. It's over 20 hours of audio education, 200 pages of paperwork, and an hour and a half of video. And it contains information that you want to know, things people ask of me over the years, how do I do this? What is this? What is that? Is this important? You know, all these things. And it's what you need to know that you don't even know to ask about. Okay? So you want to go to livefreenow.org and go on their course packages. Click on that, and you see those available. And the level one course is $300 plus $20 shipping. However, right now, until end of January, the level one course is for one time discounted to only $200 plus $20 shipping. You get $100 savings, and you still get your money back guaranteed, my friend. So I would suggest start with that so you can understand the law and your rights, what to do. You can always get the quick Start Freedom package where I can spend an hour with you personally on the phone as well as the level one course in combination. Normally that's $490 for the quick Start Freedom package, but right now it's at a discount, $100 off, only $390. So that goes for all of you folks. You've been looking at Freedom Law School for a long time, wondering what to do. Should you get our courses, Freedom packages, or not? Or you were poor and poverty-stricken during the Great Depression years from 2008 to 2015 looking for jobs. We're getting out of the Great Depression, folks, now. We're in good times again. Everybody who wants to work basically got a job these days. So this is the time that you've been waiting for to get these courses and freedom packages at discounts, and you get a job with a money-back guarantee still for the level one course, folks. Also, while we at it, let me mention to you that the beginner's Freedom packages, which includes the Quick Start Freedom package and includes the letters to congressmen and senators about the Joe Bannister We the People Foundation confrontation with the IRS and the U.S. Department of Injustice about the legality of the income tax issue. Okay, all that is included and some other videos and books and material that is only $900 normally, but it's $200 off until end of January for only $700. Folks, I've never, ever done these discounts, ever. Since pre law school, ever filed in 1996, I've never done it. Why am I doing it? Well, because the Royal Freedom Package, which is the premier package of Freedom Law School, which includes the Beginner's Freedom Package, unlimited consultation, a criminal legal defense fund, and a civil legal defense fund that pays for anything if the IRS comes after you. Okay? They come after criminally or civilly, we do all the responses for you. In a criminal case, paid attorneys for you. That program, first year, $6,000. Second year, and each other after, is $4,000. $4,500 from Californians. That's about to go up on February 1st. It started out back in 2001. It was only $5,000 for the first year. Went up to $6,000 a year, and I did not raise it during all these years of Great Depression. It's overdue for going up. It's going to go up, like I said, February 1st, to $7,000 for the first year. So you could consider yourself getting a discount by getting the Royal Freedom Package now for only $6,000 in January versus in February for $7,000. So while I'm at it, I figured I'd give you guys a discount for these other course and course packages if you can afford the Royal Freedom Package at this time. Now, you can get the small packages and move up to bigger packages and get full credit for them. And for the Royal Freedom Package, you have to pay at least $2,000 or $3,000 minimum, and you can make monthly payments on the rest of the balance if you wish to get the Royal Freedom Package. But for the other Freedom Packages to get the discounts, you must pay in full. Normally, I'll let you pay half or third down and make payments. But here, you know, you can get the discount on the beginner's quick start Freedom Packages and level one course, but you got to pay the discount price in full. So does that help you with your question and your options, Jim? Jimmy is no longer with us, my friend. Let's go to our next caller we have from area code 805. Call from Erica 805. You're live on their Freedom Hour. What is your first name, my friend?
My name is Sean.
And, hello, Sean.
I heard about you. Somebody gave me a book, Cracking the Code, and in my research in that, I came across your information.
Is Sean with S-E-N or S-H-A-W-N?
S-H-A-W-N.
Okay. And do you have a free education package?
I signed up on your website. I'm not sure if I received anything yet.
When did you sign up for it?
Are you talking about the free one? Or
yes,
the paid
one? Mailed to you. The one that the free one.
Oh, I haven't received it yet, no.
When did you request it?
Just like a couple days ago, or maybe yesterday.
Oh, okay. Yes. It's on its way to you, my friend. You'll get it probably already next week, my friend. Very good, Sean. And
awesome.
How may I assist you, my friend?
I just have a question. I'm about to start a job pretty soon, and
uh-huh.
I was wondering what someone's options would be for the W-4. And, I know we're going to write the congressman and do all that stuff and show them the laws, but it is a big company, so I doubt they'll just not withhold. So I was thinking about claiming exempt, or should I claim, 20 dependents, or what all my options are.
Well, you could temporarily do that for right now if you have to because you're about to get a job. But ideally what you should do, and by the way, you can run on the W-4 form, whether you put exempt or a large number of allowances, 20 or 50 or whatever, that you're doing it under duress. You've been forced to fill out the form you do not wish to fill out. You do not believe, you're not required to file because the employer is forcing you to do it, otherwise they will not hire you. Okay, and you can write above your signature under the address, see attached piece of paper, and attach that piece of paper to your W-4 form. Okay, and then keep a copy of that W-4 form and the attached paper that explains in more detail you are involuntarily filling out the W-4 form that doesn't apply to you at all. And then, as soon as possible, go to our website at livefreedom.org. on Freedom Law School's website, under Education Materials, go down, scroll down to How to Stop Income Tax Withholding Tax. Okay, and you click on that, and that takes you to a page. I've got conference calls that explain in more detail what I'm about to summarize for you. It's basically in that letter, you have sample letters you sent to your, all three of your congressmen, your two senators and your House member. Which, and you got to be sure to attach a copy of the statutes, Congress, from government's own website and Supreme Court case. You know, everything that's in there, attach it. Send it by certified return receipt letter to your congressman, demanding that they answer you, demanding that they, you know, show you you're wrong, refute you, which they cannot, but that's okay. You've got to give them a chance to correct you in case you missed something. Okay? They cannot do that. Once they don't show that you're wrong, whether they ignore you or whether they blow you off with some nonsense, irrelevant answer like, oh, so nice to hear from my constituents. I'm for lowering taxes, whatever. You could take that now to your employer and say, look, no more withholding from my paycheck, no more W-4s. This is the reason why I should not have to fill out W-4 at all in the first place. You're not a withholding agent, and I'm not subject to withholding because I'm not a foreigner. Only foreigners, according to law, as published for the House of Representatives, are required to be withheld from their paycheck. That's a short, skinny on what you got to do, my friend. Okay, Sean?
Okay. Okay, is signing VC before your name, is that sufficient for signing under duress?
VC, you said?
I was into the right to travel movement for a while, and they all say whenever you sign tickets or anything, you have to put V.C. And then that covers some thing.
What is that supposed to represent?
That you're signing under duress. V
what is the letter V
in Charlie?
And that is C represent. What?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, but it references something.
See, this is how
about,
ridiculous
being under duress.
Ancient mythology nonsense is. They tell you things that blow over you like they're so impressive, like, wow, we are so smart, and you're so stupid because you don't understand it. No, you're not stupid, Sean. The reason you don't understand it because they did not take the time to break it down, explain it for you. For you to understand it. And another reason they didn't do that because it doesn't make sense as basis. Anyhow, what does VC mean? It got to stand for something. IRS stands for Internal Revenue Service. FBI stands for Federal Bureau of Investigations. DOJ stands for Department of Justice. So they got to just put some initials for that, don't even know what it means, and claim it means something that you don't even know what it is yourself.
Yeah.
So, no, you don't want to do that, okay? You want to write under duress, signed involuntarily, plain English. You don't need to use legal mumbo-jumbo, some of them impressed upon you. That doesn't, you don't understand, doesn't make sense. Do not do that. That's the worst thing you got to do is to give up your brain, Sean. You are not stupid. They're the stupid ones for buying patriot mythology nonsense that doesn't even make sense until I sell down to you. And you were smart enough, you know, you started with patriot mythology, and so did I, by the way, back in 1992. I started with patriot mythology, too, because that's what's out there. All of you who heard about UCC, national or state citizenship, sovereignty, straw man, name it all capital letters, adhesion contract, straw man, redemption. You know, Admiralty Maritime versus common law and statute of jurisdiction. I'd use a zip code on your mail. Object to your name in all capital letters. And you're not, affiant. You're not dead. You're a live, sentient human being. All this nonsense out there, folks. It's just nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But people wish and believe in silver bullets, so don't go for that, Sean. Does that give you enough guidance on what to do forward from here?
Yeah, I was just wondering, what's this paper that I should staple to my W-4? You said...
A piece of paper.
You said there was...
That you elaborate that you signed this piece of paper under duress involuntarily. Because you are not a foreigner subject to withholding of income tax by your employer. You're not supposed to employ, you're supposed to withhold only from foreigners. That is sufficient, basically enough. And then and they say, I'm going to write to my congressman about this, and I will get back with you. Okay.
So claiming exempt.
So
that should be okay.
That should be attached and dated. And just you date it on that, sign and date on the second page also that you add to it.
Okay. So claiming exempt should be okay at the beginning, or is it better to claim like 20 dependents or something? Or
yeah, it doesn't matter. You would exempt. That's fine. And you can put it on the duty exempt because that's the only way to stop the stealing of money from my paycheck, you know, on the form.
Yeah.
That's what it truly is.
Yeah.
But you got to follow up with what I'm telling you. Otherwise, you could down the road be charged with tax evasion for stopping what the U.S. Department of Injustice will claim to be stopping the automatic withholding from your paycheck like everybody else. You stopped it by doing a W-4 exemption or 20 exemptions on a W-4. See, you got to do this process to protect yourself down the road, Sean, okay?
Okay. Will do.
And then consider getting these, like the beginner's freedom package. I usually should do that, at least beginner's freedom package. Write your letters to Congressman about the income tax fraud to protect yourself. And then move up down the road. If you're a wage earner now, don't make that much. You can step up to the Royal Freedom Package as soon as you can. But at least start with the beginner's freedom package, which is right now on sale for only $700 versus $900. Okay?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be. Yep, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Sean. Thank you for your question, my friend.
All
right, folks, looks like we're going to be done with the Freedom Hour now because I don't see anybody else, with a question. You know, if you do have a question, folks, last chance, push 1 on your telephone keypad, and I will take your question. Oh, we have another caller now from area code 562, looks like. Area code with a question. All right, my friend, what is your first name? Calling from Long Beach, California area. I used to live down there in the International Communist Republic of Mexicana, around there in Long Beach area. What's your first name? Where do you live?
It's D.C., Los Angeles County.
Where's D.C.?
D.C., yeah.
What city?
It's Los Angeles County.
I know Long Beach is part of Los Angeles County, but what city do you live in?
La Mirada.
La Mirada. Oh, okay, got it. Yes. Very good. Yes, B.C. Oh, B.C. is your first name. I got it. So do you have a free... Freedom Education Package, BC?
Yes, I'm slow to understand everything. So it's taking me time here. And
well, hold on, all of you. Can listen to this conference call with an after to this weekly Freedom Show on our blogtalkradio.com. It's there within half hour on our mouth. You can listen to it as many time as you want. You don't need to take notes right now necessarily. And our YouTube channel, we have all of them also as well. You can go Freedom Law's YouTube channel and listen to this and other calls that interest you. Listen to them as many times as you wish.
Okay.
So no problem. What is on your mind, DC?
Well, I've gone as far as signing the tax when I do the tax forms, when the CPA does it or what have you, I won't go ahead and put on there signing involuntarily. I do that. Is that the right wording? Just signing under duress involuntarily? Is that all I need to write?
And then you say after that, see the attached paper for more details. And on that attached paper, you will explain in detail a little bit more that, because there's not that much room on the W-4 form to write these notes. It's full of, small prints. You can. That's why you need to make a small notation and then refer to the other piece of paper, which in bigger print and more detail can explain that you assign this all under duress.
Okay. And in the detail, the separate detail paper, what should I include in there?
Like I said, the last call, you can listen to it again on recording on this call. Say, I'm not a foreigner subject to withholding from my paycheck as provided by the IRS code. Okay? and my employer is not supposed to withhold from my paycheck. I will write to my congressman about it and get back. And that's to stop stealing of my money. I'm forced to fill out this form and put exempt on it. I'm going to write to my congressman about it and get back with you. That's it. That will do.
Okay. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you is, I have I've been suffering with a memory issue, and so because of that, I've, and not only that, I'm not an expert, so I didn't know that I was supposed to file my taxes for refund within the 3-year limit. They give you just 3 years, but they said also that if you have some kind of cognitive impairment, that they would accept it. But the advocate, the IRS advocate that I spoke to at the time, did not accept it. She ignored it. She ignored my neurologist's letter. And so now she has me going to court. And someone that I talked to said that maybe I can appeal it. So what would you suggest I do? Should I try and appeal this again, or do I go to court? And if I do, what should I prepare myself with?
I don't understand what the initial problem is.
The initial problem is that they do not want to release the 2012 refund.
Who's they? Who's they?
The IRS.
They didn't want to release what?
The 2012 refund.
You saw the 1040 income tax confession form. They're supposed to give a refund. They didn't. Is that what you mean?
That's correct, because I filed 3 months late.
Well, I gotta look at the paperwork to give you an answer. You know, maybe because you filed late, and the penalties for that wiped out your refund. But without looking at the papers, I cannot tell you. It is no silver bullet guarantee magic answer I can give you. I gotta look at the paperwork. How much the refund would have been, in your opinion, if it was properly done?
No, I have a refund of approximately $5,000 to $7,000. But they refuse to do it because there's a time limit, and I did not adhere to the time limit.
No. If you file the form and then they give it to you, you can go to court and force the IRS to give it to you. Okay? Let's go to the one-on-one consultation. Mm-hmm. You can go to court.
Go where?
And have the IRS.
Go to court.
And have the IRS give the money to you. Yes.
Go to court and do what?
And ask the court to enforce the refund.
To enforce the refund.
No, the IRS will give your money back to you.
But wouldn't I need an attorney, and that's going to cost me?
Well, it's going to cost you something. If you're lost, can do help you with that, lost to an attorney. But you don't necessarily need an attorney. Not to mention attorneys, most of them do not know how to handle taxes anyhow.
I know.
So probably what we should do is, before we even go that far, just go to and send me a copy of paperwork. Do a one-on-one private consultation with me, which is normally $360 for 1 hour, but first hour is only $240. And let me go over that with you in an hour, see what's going on, and evaluate it before we go forward, before you spend more money on this thing that may not be even worth your time. I don't know, maybe just forget about it and move on. You know?
Yeah.
But you may want to get a quick start for your package on sale for $390. Get one on consultation and get a level 1 course. You know, you're going to get for $190 level 1 course with shipping, which is a heck of a deal. Okay, but I cannot tell you more without seeing what you file with the IRS, what it shows.
Yeah, it's just that. It's just that. It's just the fact that she did not, this advocate that
Hold on. You're saying just that is useless. It's like you're calling the doctor. Hey, doctor, you're expert. On the phone, could you fix me? Oh, yeah, that's it. I got that. I got that problem. You still got to come see the doctor to examine you fully. Even if he knows what you got, he's got to examine you fully to see what you got and then tell you what to do. Even though he cannot examine you by telephone, can he? Neither can I. Your tax situation without seeing the numbers and what you filed with the IRS, what you put in there. I got to see the exact details, what you filed with the IRS, when you filed it, all that stuff.
Yeah, but if
there's no simple magic for back in BC, okay?
I understand that. No, I understand that. I understand what you're saying. But what I'm asking you is, if I go to court and I just ask him to enforce the refund, can I do that on my own?
Well, do you know how to do it on your own? On your own completely? No, because you don't know. As a field marshal student,
right.
I can help you get the paperwork done if you get it done right. If we can do it, then you can file it as you are yourself, as you're presenting your own case without an attorney. Yes, you can do it that
okay.
way.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. So you'll be able to help me to know exactly what to do when I go to court?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So how do I do a one-on-one with you then?
Like I said, I do send the $240 for 1 hour prepaid consultation or quick start for the package $390, which includes a level one course, cash only to Freedom Law School. You can put your paperwork in the package, in the priority mail package you sent only, priority or express mail. And then you call for the tracking number. You can also email your paperwork to Freedom Law School. And as soon as your package is received in the mail, we set up a time for us to talk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. May I have that address again, please?
It's on our website at livefreenow.org.
Oh, it's the one on the website.
At livefreenow.org. On our website, at the very bottom of every single page, there's a link that says Contact Us. You click on that Contact Us. Has our phone number, our address, P.O. Box 1059 in Brooksville, Florida. That's all there.
Okay.
Okay.
And now you said something about 240. What is 240 for?
$240 cash for 1 hour of prepaid consultation with me.
Oh, prepaid consultation. Okay. So I could either do that or I can either mail you the package and you can tell me what to do when I go to court.
Both. You do both. And that does not include me helping you go to court. That's just to evaluate your situation. Evaluate what you got. That doesn't cover me doing it all for you. I wish it was that simple, as it was that cheap.
Yeah.
You know, this stuff is not simple thing you can do like here. Let me give you a cone, go fill it up with a yogurt ice cream. It's not that easy.
Right.
This is complex work. It takes a lot of knowledge and research. I know you used to get here's a cup. Go fill up the Coke in your cup with ice yourself. There's not simple stuff like that. You can pay someone minimum wage to do it. Okay?
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, thank you. I appreciate your help.
You are welcome. You're welcome, BC. My pleasure. Okay, folks, does anybody else have any last questions on the Freedom Hour? Go ahead and click 1 on your telephone keypad. That will let me know you have a question. But other than that, folks, I want to thank you all for being with me. Next week, folks, hopefully we have everything in together. Go to our YouTube channel. Again, youtube.com, Freedom Law School YouTube channel. Sign up for notifications. We're going to be broadcasting live, hopefully, on YouTube next week, folks. You guys can see my computer monitor. When I put stuff, you can look it up on your smartphone or your personal computer. So with that, folks, thank you for being with me, and I'll be back with you next Thursday night again on the Freedom Hour. Good night.